Dan Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Linda Kenyon. The Hamas-run health ministry claims the death toll in Gaza now tops 15,000 amid the renewed war with Israel. CBS's Bradley Blackburn has the latest.
Israel says its war with Hamas is back at full strength, with operations on the ground in Gaza and in the air overhead. Israel says it has destroyed 400 terror targets since the ceasefire ended. Hamas continues to fire rockets into Israel. In a televised address, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the ground operation necessary and said war will continue until Israel achieves its goals.
Those goals include getting Hamas to release its hostages.
Even while the negotiations have stopped, we haven't stopped. Our efforts on the National Security Council and all the way up to the president, trying to work hour by hour to see if we can get this pause reinstated and get those hostages out.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby on CBS's Face the Nation. In Queens, New York, Chief of Department Jeffrey Madry describes a chaotic scene in which a man killed four of his own family members and then a fire.
And once the fire was extinguished and we were able to get into the apartment, we found another three victims all dead. We believe everyone who was dead, the four family members, were all because of stab wounds.
Chief Madry says the suspect was shot by police after he confronted them with a knife. Two of the officers were injured. A suspect has been arrested in connection with the fatal shooting of at least three homeless people in Los Angeles. Mayor Karen Bass says the city is breathing a sigh of relief.
The individual responsible for these horrific crimes was found, caught, and will now be held accountable.
The victims were shot while they slept. In Las Vegas, more crimes against the homeless. CBS's Matt Piper has that story.
Las Vegas police are searching for a lone suspect in the shootings of five homeless people, one of them fatally. They say the shooting occurred in an unhoused encampment. Vegas Police Lieutenant Jason Johansson.
All we have is that they witnessed us all, a black male in a hoodie, flee the area in a dark sedan. Right now, we are trying to confirm that information.
A man in his 50s died. Another man is in critical condition, and three others are in stable condition. Matt Piper, CBS News.
Remember Kiss? The band is retiring. Here's something to make sure you'll never forget them. At their final concert at Madison Square Garden in New York last night, they announced their avatars will go on tour. During their encore, the band's current lineup left the stage to reveal their digital avatars, allowing them to live on in virtual immortality. This is CBS News.
You don't need a job platform, you need a hiring partner. Indeed lets you schedule and conduct virtual interviews all from one place. Start at Indeed.com/credits.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Timeout.
Oh, right. Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to...
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. New research shows more people are dying because of air pollution from coal-fired power plants than once thought. As Mike Moan reports, environmentalists in Wisconsin hope the study spurs quicker action to curb emissions.
The study, led by experts at a handful of U.S. universities, found that over the past two decades, there were 460,000 premature deaths nationally associated with fine particulate matter sent into the air from coal-fired power plants. That's more than what health and scientific communities had previously thought. Kieran Gallagher with the group Clean Wisconsin says while coal facilities are being phased out, utilities and policymakers should speed up the energy transition.
A lot of wind and solar is being added to the electricity grid every day, which is really exciting to see in Wisconsin, across the Midwest, and it just needs to ramp up faster.
Utilities around the U.S. have announced emissions goals, but some companies contend certain fossil fuels can't be completely put to rest right away because of electricity demands while cleaner sources are added. But Gallagher says the regulatory scene in states like Wisconsin makes it easier for utilities to move the goalposts. She's hopeful stricter standards being weighed by the federal EPA will prompt stronger commitments. Gallagher has analyzed the proposed regulations and says that in Wisconsin, they could result in nearly $50 million in broader health benefits by reducing the impact of respiratory illnesses and cardiovascular disease.
$50 million is a massive benefit for Wisconsinites to see in health benefits from the closed coal plants in our state.
Meanwhile, study authors show that the rate of deaths from coal pollution began to slow as more plants were being shut down. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app. Did you know this local radio station is part of Civic Media? Learn more about the entire network at civicmedia.us.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw.
Chance for mixed precipitation this afternoon, otherwise overcast. Highs around 37, northwest winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Cloudy again tonight, 27. A dusting of snow tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Derek Height. Currently, it's 34 degrees.
Keeping Southeast Wisconsin informed, engaged, and entertained. This is The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Cripes Cast. I'm your host, Charlie Behrens, and this is the podcast where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest. We are brought to you by Jolly Good Soda, and here is today's episode. Hey, folks, welcome to another episode of the Cripes Cast. Today, my guest is comedian Sam J. She's got a new special out on HBO called Salute Me or Shoot Me. It's super funny. She's also been a writer on SNL, the first Black and lesbian writer, I believe, in the show's history. She's also a writer for You People and Bust Down. And she is the co-creator and co-star of the HBO comedy series Pause. With Sam J. So make sure you check out all of those. And my conversation with her is coming up in a second. Before we get to that, I am joined virtually in the Cripescast studios by Colleen Maraca. Colleen, what's cooking up in Minnesota, huh?
There's snow on the ground.
On the ground in Milwaukee. We got that in common. We've got that in common. Yeah.
But yeah, we got the Christmas lights up this last weekend. I'm looking out at my parents' lake. It's like frozen every morning. It has a sheet and then it like kind of goes away. So this looks like it's staying a little bit longer, but they have like a bet every year with their like neighbors of whoever chooses the right date or whoever's like the farthest from the date has to get like beer for the first like party.
Like, oh really?
When it like officially freezes over, and then also when the ice comes back, or when it like goes in the spring. So,
the lake freezing games are a lot of fun. I was in Menominee, Wisconsin, at one point, and in the winter they drive a car out on the ice, and then you bet on the day that the car falls through the ice. Now, let me also say, I think that the car doesn't have its engine in it anymore because that's technically a fine from the DNR.
Yeah.
They do something to it. But anyway, yeah, you bet on when it falls through the ice. Who says we're not fun up here in the Midwest? You know?
No, I was going to say, like, first of all, whose car is second? Like, is it the loser of the last year? Like, their car goes.
Yeah. That'd be funny. Doesn't matter what car it is.
Yeah.
Got to take the engine out, have someone trailer it out there by the dude who won. The dude who wins gets to trailer it out there, drop it off, and then everyone gets to bet on that. Man, that's fun. I like those high stakes situations. I like real losers. I don't just like real winners. I want real losers too. Someone where it's gonna hurt.
Real consequences.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fair enough. We wonder why like our earth is going to because we like use cars to pollute the lakes.
Yeah, well, that's also what they take the engine. Apparently, they take everything out that's going to do anything bad. Because if you just essentially have the frame, well, that's not true. Because there's probably stuff on there.
Like the little ecosystem below is like excited for a truck to like demolish their home that they've built.
Well, see, here's where you're wrong. Here's where you're wrong, Colleen. Okay. Because fish love structure. You dump a car, they don't, I mean, as long as there's not a lot of gas in it, but that gas will go away eventually, and the fish are going to make that their little coral reef, man. They love structure because structure.
Have you talked to the fish? Have they told you that?
Yeah. Structure allows you to hide from a bass. You know what I mean? Like, you can get in these little nooks and crannies where a bass can't get you. Haven't you seen Finding Nemo or The Little Mermaid?
Isn't that a commentary about, like, people leaving their junk in the ocean and, like, not taking care of the earth?
Yeah, but they also use those things. I'm not saying you should do this. I'm not saying you should.
Sounds like you are, but...
No, a better way to do it is drop a Christmas tree. Drop your Christmas tree down in front of your dock. That's a natural structure. That's pretty much its natural habitat. And so anywhere you create structure underwater is where fish will be.
How was your Thanksgiving?
Hung out, did the Thanksgiving things, cleaned the basement.
Did you really?
Yeah. I mean, I cleaned, I would say, half of it, like the business half where all the merch is and the wardrobe.
Nice.
And I reorganized it and I put stuff out because everything was in boxes. And man, I'm bringing this up because what an emotional experience cleaning stuff up. I did the thing where it's like, do I really need this? And I got like, there's a whole truckload ready to go to Goodwill. I found some relics from when I was a kid, you know, I just threw them out and just felt lighter because of it. You Whoa. Know, old relationships, things that people had given me, ornaments that have never come out of the box.
Oh, that's so fair.
Like, I was like, you know what?
I went over to my brother and his wife's house and I was helping them with Christmas decorations because Megan's like about to give birth, so she couldn't like do a ton. And we were going through their ornaments and stuff, and like she has like a box of ornaments that she had like from her childhood. And then there's some ornament, like it's such a like a parent grandparent thing to give an ornament for a specific year, you know? Like,
yeah.
Like, yeah. So my Nona, my grandma, she got us all like two ornaments for 2020. One of them was like the year we'll never forget. And it's like all of the things that were like canceled because of 2020. And then she got us a Santa with a mask on it. And we're like, why do you want things that remind you of like the worst year of like our life? Like, it just was such a funny like choice that she gave us those ornaments. And so we were like putting it up on the tree. And Megan's like, I think we could keep that one in the box. let's put up ornaments of like the year we got engaged, like our dog, all that stuff. She's like, I don't really want to remember like the year that we had to like move our wedding. And I was like, yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
Isn't that funny? Like I feel like a lot of people, I also came up with a lot of 2020 stuff in the box of crap that I had down there. And I think you just like take a big, you want to shove that thing into something else as soon as possible. Yeah. It's weird. I wonder if enough time will go by that we'll look at it nostalgically.
I mean, there's always silver linings. Like, there were some things in it. Like, I'd say, like, I wouldn't have gotten this job if it weren't for COVID. Like, that's for sure. And then...
Really? Why?
Because everywhere else wasn't hiring.
Oh, get the hell out of here. Oh, my God. Wow.
No, did but like,
you, did you guys what? All that was the sickest burn that I think you've ever though. Done.
Like, no, but like, let me explain. It ended up being like the best thing that's happened to me. Like, I'm not gonna like, but I wouldn't have applied because I had like other jobs that were like I was going through, and it was a complete. Remember when we first talked about my job and you were like, what's your goal? And I was like, healthcare communications. Like, what a losery goal for me. Yeah. Do you remember that at all? Probably not.
You know what? I really don't. But if you would have said healthcare communications, I would probably. I mean, that is a goal for some people.
No, but then shortly after we were on the phone, this was the first time you and I had like ever talked. And I was like, well, like dream job would be to like write a TV show. And you were like, why did you say healthcare communication? Like,
yeah. Yeah. I was confused. Like, why are you already setting yourself up for what you don't want to do? What was that inside you that made you want to do that?
I had already had experience doing that. I had worked previously at healthcare communications. I was doing classes that like were doing that. So my family's in healthcare. So Got like it. It was not necessarily a dream, but more realistic step.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? Like it wasn't really a dream. Let's be realistic here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Long story short, this is the best job of my life. And like, this is the best job I could ever ask for. And like, I love my job so much.
Oh, you really saved yourself. Yeah. No. And, yeah. Don't worry about it. What else do we got to talk about here? Do we have anything else we have to announce to the people?
Well, so you have a second show in New York that was announced. And then I think you're all sold out in Eau Claire, but there might be like single seats left. So that's like the shows coming up in December. I believe those are the only ones that you have.
Yep. And of course, we've got the new album out, Dive Bar Dinner.
Yes.
Got that on mantuagmint.com. If you guys are into music, check it out, or you can find it on Spotify, you know, give it a sample before you decide to get the vinyl. We do have vinyls.
It's great. I really like, and I'm not even saying that with like, I'm just like, it's really good. It's a lot. It's great. And then yeah. I was just looking at your, tour dates. That's why, but, Eau Claire, yeah, everything's sold out for those shows. New York City, we added another show, and then come January, you're going to be touring quite a bit. We have like a leg of shows in North Dakota, and then you're going to be going out east, and then you're coming back to a leg of shows in Illinois, and then we have some in Minnesota. So it's just check it out. There's a lot of new dates being added in the new year. So that's what I would say to any updates there.
Sounds great. All right. And without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is my conversation with comedian Sam Jay. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. Thanks so much for jumping on. Did you have a good Thanksgiving?
Oh, it was decent. I can't complain. My fiance's family came over.
Oh, that's cool.
She kicked it with her family.
I always think Thanksgiving's a good time to get material. My little niece, she had this little baby lamb, this little lamb doll, and she put it in the seat of like her little vanity with the mirror. And she said, the lamb is gone, but don't worry. It's always in your heart. And I was like, where the hell? Like 3 years old, man. 3 years old. I was like, where did you learn that? Yeah, it was. Anyway, so I'll find some way to make fun of that. Your new special is great. I really loved it. And I thought the jokes are hilarious. The relationship stuff and all the things about empathy is cool. Were you kind of setting out to almost tackle empathy in a way with that? Or did that kind of happen over time?
It just kind of happened over time. Like, just kind of trying to figure out what the theme was and the conversations. And it was kind of closer to like the last few months I was touring that just seemed like empathy was just an idea that just kept coming up. And I think overall, it's just kind of a thing that comes up in my art.
Yeah, it's certainly something that resonates quite a bit today where, you know, it's stuff you brought up. People are very busy yelling at each other and all that. Do you think like there's been a shift? Was it just social media that shifted it? I know it's been an issue all along, but I feel like it's been heightened and heightened.
Like what way?
Like I feel like we've become more and more polarized since maybe 2008 or something, maybe 2000. And maybe it's just because I haven't been paying attention to it or wasn't looking before, but I think we've just become more and more polarized as a country, going red or blue or whatever. And then we just seem to be doing this, you know, to the extremes.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I mean, I think it's definitely social media, the ability to, I guess, tailor your information, you know, like the algorithm just feeds you what you want to see rather than the diversity of opinion and what's going on in the world. So if you're like I read, for example, just with this Israel and Palestine situation, I read like two things that were pro-Palestine, and now that's all that comes on my feed. There's no like information. There's no like, you know, unbiased party. Now all I get is all this pro-Palestine stuff. So it's like, if I was someone who didn't want to go do other research or read anything else or look anywhere else, just to get a rounded view so I could form my own actual opinion, and I just deep dive into that rhetoric, then that's all I believe. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't have any other source of information. So I think people are just having these really singular conversations
yeah.
with themselves and their computer. And, you know, that's not healthy.
Yeah, no, it's not. Yeah, especially in that issue. I feel like you're hard one way, you're hard a different way. And we've taken teams. We just take teams with everything, you know?
With everything.
It's like shirts or skins, you know?
Yeah.
Do you think there's any way around that or coming back from that?
I mean, it's hard because we've allowed this to now be the way we get information, which is, I think, very dangerous. And like, you know, through that, it feels like we're not even like, it's no regulation. Like, at least when you had to put something in a newspaper, like there's a process. So it has to be factual. You've had to do some level of fact checking. And if it comes back to be untrue, you have to do a redaction, like legally, and say, hey, we found out that this thing we printed is not true. Like, a blogger doesn't have any obligation to do that. A blogger can just say some and then just go about their business. And it's like people are getting more and more of their information from invalid sources because they don't trust the sources that we validated. And that's also not their fault. You know, this country is built on a lot of lies, and people are starting to discover that, and they're becoming distrusting of our institutions as a result of that, and searching for information in other places. So it's a really like a rock in a hard place type situation, because you can't fault people for their lack of trust and seeking out information in the way that they are. But also, like, there needs to be some gatekeeping to preserve the integrity of the conversations.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like that old school, like, local, like, neighborhood journalism type thing, which has always been underfunded, finding a way for people to care about that to the point where there'd be money behind it or something. Mm. But I don't know. We're probably not going to solve that issue here today, but fun to chit-chat about. So where did you grow up, and how'd you get your start in comedy?
I grew up in Boston, and then I moved to Atlanta for a little while, like college age, and then came back to Boston. I started comedy in Boston. You know, I started at mics, like very typical, just going to a bunch of open mics in the city, bar shows, and, you know, 3 minutes turns to 5 minutes, 5 minutes turns to 10, 10 turns to 15, and you just keep building the time, and the process of building the time, building your reputation. And that got me to do some stuff outside the city, and that allowed me to move around, and it just kept kind of building from there.
Yeah, kind of the old school method of stand-up, as opposed to like some clips blowing up online and then you can sell out shows or whatever, right?
Yeah. No, I didn't do it that way.
Do you have some thoughts about comedians who do it that way? Do you have, it's a different way of doing it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just there's all these different approaches now. You know, I don't know. Like, it's weird because you never want to be like hating on anybody or, you know, knocking anybody's hustle. But I will say, like, the quality, I don't know. The quality of comedy, I think, has gone down. I think it's because people can just go online and they can blow up through those type of means and kind of, again, tailor the experience. You know what I mean? They can take crowd work clips or clips of their set, and then they can funnel it in a way where even if the show was dead and it was horrible, they can make it not look like that for the person viewing on the internet, you know what I'm saying? Right. And then kind of skip a step, you know, of going through like the necessary growing pains that kind of grow you as a comic and grow your POV, you know what I'm saying? And then they gonna, you know, get an agent because they have however many followers, and the agents don't care. Like, you know, I hate to, you know, be about it, but they don't care about the integrity of stand-up. They care about making money. So if you can fill a large venue, they're going to tell you to fill it, even if you're not ready to do it, even if your material is not at a place to hold that type of space for an hour. They'll just go like, sure, you know, and then you'll make money. So you're not going to stop. You're making 40K in a weekend. Are you going to stop making 40K in a weekend? Because I'm saying, oh, that's not good comedy. No. Why would you do that? That doesn't make any sense. So you just keep going, you know? And I think, you know, just how music kind of got up in that kind of same way, it just starts to degrade and you know, disintegrate the quality of what's out there. And then if the audiences get used to low quality, then they think that is quality. It changes the whole thing.
Yeah, that's really interesting comparing it to music, because it used to be the album is what people wanted, like how to make a good album. Then it became a hit. And now it's like...
it's off of TikTok.
It's right. It's a sound. And they build the album in some cases around the sound, if there's even an album, or it's just the hook, which is, I don't know. I mean, it's a different way of thinking about it. But at the end of the day, that's really interesting. What you're saying is that the audiences get used to that. And then it becomes a standard. And I don't know if that kind of gives, you know, someone like you an advantage where you're like schooled in coming up on. So when they see you, they're blown away. But have you seen differences in audiences where they're coming and maybe like prompting like crowd work things, or have you seen a difference in your audience?
I mean, I feel like audiences in general, because of all the crowd work videos and all that, they're more chatty. They'll talk at you more because they think they're helping. They think, you know, sometimes they're coming to be a part of the show now, like, which, I mean, you know, for me and my style, like, I don't particularly appreciate it, but mm-hmm. I guess if you're there to do crowd work, then that works for you. You know what I mean? But I do think audiences are a little more chatty, and they do, like, I just never want the audience to feel like I'm dependent on them to do it. It's like, this is a shared experience, but I'm up here. I know what I'm out here to do. And like, it isn't reliant on you doing anything. You know what I'm saying? Not even really laughing. You know, that would be nice. But what I have and what I know that I want to do isn't reliant on that. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know. It does feel like they feel a little bit more empowered in a way that can be annoying.
Yeah. What was your first stand-up experience, like your first mic or whatever?
Like the very first time I did stand up, I don't really remember it. I just remember it wasn't good, and I was like, this wasn't good. I just remember it didn't feel like I thought it was gonna feel. Whatever connection I thought I was gonna feel when I got on stage, I didn't feel that, and it wasn't good. And I was just like, I don't know about this. And then I kind of fell back from it for some years. And then when I got back up and I did my first open mic, it was kind of like, I got booed. And then I was kind of like, it didn't really, like, I knew I was going to keep doing it because I wasn't like devastated by getting booed or anything. I was just like, I don't know, it happens. You're going to get booed sometimes, I guess, if you keep doing this and you're trying to figure it out. You know what I mean? So it didn't like destroy me. So I was like, oh, okay, I think you're ready to do this. Like whatever I was in my head about, which is probably a million things. I was so young, you know, at that first time. I was probably like 21. I hadn't even come out yet. I didn't even fully understand myself. So I'm sure I was just lost, period. And being up there and so exposed in that moment kind of magnified for me how actually lost I was. But the next time I knew me and I knew myself, and I was very sure of who I was and what I wanted. And so I felt that up there, and that was really the confidence I pulled on till I figured out how to do it.
So 21, that was the first time you went up, or that was when you went back up?
No, that was the first time I went
first
up.
First time. And you said it was like a couple of years since you got back on stage after that first time?
Mm-hmm.
So what drove you to get on stage the first time?
I wanted to do it.
But then you do it and you just said, well, that's not for me. And then did something push you back on stage?
Simple. I don't think it's that easy. I did it and it didn't feel right. And I had a friend and we went out to do it together and he had crushed. And I was like, oh, that's what it's supposed to be like. So then I kind of was just like hanging around comedy, kind of trying to just figure it out, go to shows and shit. Then I got sick and I was in the hospital for a while. Then when I got out, I was like dealing with my family. So I moved, you know, just life happens. Yeah. And I moved to Atlanta and I lived a little bit and I was doing other shit. It's just life, you know, and life brought me back around to it. So I don't think it was that black and white, but, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, I got you. And then so you just, the next time you went up, you feel like ready to do it? Or was it like, did you have more of a set on it or like good material you thought, or was it kind of the same?
I mean, I didn't have like, I wasn't really doing it. So it's not like I had a set. It just was a confidence thing. It's just a knowledge of self thing that was more intact than when the first time. So I just had more confidence that I was going to be able to figure it out.
Yeah. Yeah. I just ask, we got a lot of standups. I listen to the podcast and first time I went up, I just bombed so hard. I didn't even go back up for 6 months. So I'm just always interested in those stories of like, I went up and then left for a while, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're doing, standup at that point. Is it a kind of just a thing you're doing because you enjoy it, or were you at that point of like, no, I am going to do this?
No, I was from the door. I was like, this is what I'm going
to
do.
What were you doing to just live life at that point and pay the bills?
I had a bunch of, I feel like right when I got to Boston, what was I doing? I really don't remember what my first job was. But I mean, I was like, I think I was working at the John Hancock in the mailroom. Yeah. I know I did that for a while. I think that's what I was doing.
God, so you were doing something to pay the bills and mm-hmm. doing that. What, like the Boston comedy scene, how is that different than maybe other comedy scenes you've been to and experienced?
I don't know that it is. I guess it's just smaller. You know what
just
I mean?
Smaller. Like, yeah.
Like scenes. Like comedy is kind of the same everywhere you go.
You have, yeah.
your local, you have your local comics, you have your bar shows, you have a few clubs that everyone's trying to get into. You have the bookers everyone hates. You have the one booker who's kind of the gatekeeper of the city. I mean, but it's also like every time you level up, you're in a different scene. You know what I'm saying? So I was an open micer in Boston that moved to somewhat of a regular at clubs. Then I moved to LA, back in the open mic scene, but not in the same way, like, cause at least people know me now. So it's different, you know, it's different than walking in a scene and nobody knows who the f- you are. No one's ever heard you tell a joke. No one has any references of you. And you're kind of fighting your way through that scene to landing somewhere. And people are like, oh, that's Sam J. I heard about her. She's funny. Da, da, da. And you're kind of moving through that a little easier. Then by the time I get to New York, I'm not in an open mic scene. I'm not doing bar. I don't know. So honestly, I don't know what the f- they're doing, to be quite honest yeah. with you. Because I don't do that. So it's like, you know, but I'm yeah. sure it's to some degree the same. You know what I mean? As yeah. how it works.
No. Yeah, that totally makes sense. What was sort of the moment where you kind of got like that big break or that moment? Was it the Comedy Center, or has it all just felt like a gradual climb?
It all just feels like, I mean, objectively, someone looking in would probably say something. I don't know. I don't know what they would say, but they would probably feel like, oh, the big break has happened. In my mind, it hasn't yet, because but also I don't know what that is really. You just keep doing.
You're like, you know, a joke, I mean? At like, a time kind of a thing.
You know, I think I'll feel like, oh, it's happening. What I want to see happen, when that club to theater transition really happens and I'm consistently in theaters and kind of moving into that space. Then I think I'll feel like, oh, okay. This is the build I wanted to see. But like, so I don't know that it's like a big break. You just keep working.
Yeah. Is that the goal for you? If you could do anything, would it be just straight doing stand up, kind of selling out those theaters, one tour, do a special, another tour, do a special? Or I know you're doing TV as well. I know you're writing as well. Do you have like, where you want to take it in an ideal world?
I just want to be able to make stuff. I don't know that it's like, oh, the ultimate goal is to do theaters. That is a goal for sure. It's one of the many goals I have, and it's an important one to me. But, you know, I want to write a book. I want to develop like a show, like a network show. I'd like to take a crack at, you know, making classic television and what that feels. I just like want to be able to make stuff and create for as long as I can. I don't know that it lives in any particular box like that.
Yeah. How do you think the network shows and all that? I mean, we just had this writer's strike and everything. Do you think those are going to continue to be like a mainstay and like sort of how people like are entertained? Or do you think like, they'll fade? Do you think they'll find sort of a new thing with the streamers? Do you have any thoughts on all that?
I mean, but the streamers are just making network shows. It's not different. It's not like the streamers doing something different. They're just making sitcoms and series.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they're just in a more flooded pool over there, you know?
Yeah, so but it's not, you know what I mean? Stuff. Like the thing isn't different. I think people will, like, sitcoms feel good and people will always, you know, like that stuff. Like thematically, they might make sure how they are written can change because, you know, the way we view TV and process TV and just, you know, we process things differently than we did 20, 40, 30, 60, you know, whatever. So all that stuff, of course, it always changes. But I think the base of it, you know, won't. I think the streamers aren't like, they're not reinventing the wheel. They're just, you know, repackaging it.
Yeah. I mean, you don't think that idea of like, we're all so used to like doing this, that format is going to go away. You think that format will always kind of be there in some way, the longer form thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think we over obsess about that. I think we also lean too heavily on like letting the youth dictate stuff. And it's like they're kids, they don't know. So yes, a kid who's running around outside and has their phone probably only will sit still for 15 minutes and watch something. But when that kid turns 30, they'll probably watch television.
Yeah. I just wonder like if all these brains are built around, you know, this from like the time you're like being babysat now, you know, I mean, I was watching my niece and I was like, here, just watch this for a little bit. You know, that I punted immediately, you know? So,
yeah, but how is that different than TV was for us when we were young? You know what I mean? Like,
you can't do that, you know, but you can do that.
You can do this.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't know. I just like thinking about that stuff just from where is it all going? But I guess it doesn't really matter. You know, it's going to do what it's going to do.
It's going to do what it's going to do. And there'll be some version of it is all I'm saying. I don't think it goes away. I think it'll just be a new version of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Your home of the Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings from 8 till 10 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK.
CBS News Brief. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby says efforts continue to try to secure the release of hostages, even as the war between Israel and Hamas has resumed.
We are still working it really hard, hour by hour, to see if we can't get the sides back to the table and see if we can't get something moving. We would like that to happen today, but honestly, I just don't know.
Admiral Kirby was speaking on NBC. Snow is bearing down on New England, and Bob Orovic is at the National Weather Service.
Snowfall totals look like they're going to be in the 6 to 12-inch range across portions of northwest Maine, northern New Hampshire, northern Vermont, and very small portions of northern New York State.
In Queens, New York, a man has killed four of his family members before he was shot to death by police. Chief of Department Jeffrey Madry.
At the scene, the weapon that was used to injure the officers, a typical kitchen steak knife.
Two officers injured. CBS News Brief. I'm Linda Kenyon.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
A big win for Bucky. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Wisconsin Badgers with a huge win over the Marquette Golden Eagles. The final score 75-64 in favor of Wisconsin. Badgers head coach Greg Gard.
The environment, the atmosphere, the fans were terrific. We kind of envisioned what this team can be.
NBA, the Bucks pulled ahead late to beat the Atlanta Falcons. 132-121. A big night for the Bucks' Cam Payne, who scored a season-high 18 points in the win.
Finally got one in front of the fans. I appreciate the support. Man, but I'm going to keep bringing that energy. Y'all keep bringing that energy, man, and we're going to keep getting wins.
Sunday night football at Lambeau Field. Chiefs quarterback Patrick Mahomes on the Packers and Jordan Love.
Jordan's gotten better and better at every single game. He's always had the talent. So you can see how much more comfortable he's getting. And their defense can play. They got a lot of guys that can play football. And we have to try to match that confidence and find a way to win a football game.
That's Patrick Mahomes with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
Don't change the station, but do watch out for deer, would ya? You know, they're running around all willy-nilly. It is the Cripescast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
Here's your updated forecast on the Shaw.
Chance for mixed precipitation this afternoon. Otherwise, overcast. Highs around 37. Northwest winds 8 to 15 miles an hour. Cloudy again tonight, 27. A dusting of snow tomorrow night. For Civic Media, I'm meteorologist Eric Height. Currently, it's 34 degrees.
It's fully leaded education talk. Hard facts with a humorous twist. Check out Busted Pencils, Tuesdays at 7 on The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM WAUK, and on the Civic Media app.
Wisconsin, tune in for my brand new show, Nightlight, starting Monday, December 4th. Join me, Pete Schwabe, for conversations on the best in entertainment and culture every weeknight from 8 to 10. Nightlight, across the Civic Media radio network and on the app.
Why choose Weichert Realtors? Because your community is our community. We're your neighbors, your students, your chefs, your soldiers, your builders, your actors, your musicians, and your radio personalities. We love this city as much as you do, and that's why we want to help you live your best life here. Because we are your realtors. Call us today and let us help you find your next home. 608-821-7002 or visit Weichert-LakePoint.com. Weichert Realtors Lake Point, a home for all.
This is Mean Gene Okerlund, and I'm talking with Brett Uhlberg, owner of Robert Hack Diamonds. Brett, I hear you pay cash for gold.
Not only gold, but silver, diamonds in any form like jewelry, teeth, coins, flatware.
Why should I sell you my gold?
Why not? Our store is the only store that recommends you shop around before you sell. This way you know you're getting the most money. But if Robert Hack Diamonds can't beat a competitor's offer on your scrap gold, we'll give you $20 just for letting us try.
Hey, what if I'm shy?
You? Well, at Robert Hack Diamonds, we sit with you at a table. We go through your items and make you an offer. You're not pressured, and we offer more on jewelry that we can resell.
Can I trade my gold for a new piece of jewelry?
Of course you can, and not only that, we can custom make a piece of jewelry using your gold and gems.
Hey, there you have it, folks. Sell your gold to my friends at Robert Hack Diamonds. Visit them on 76th and Layton in Greenfield. Robert Hack Diamonds, where they want your business.
Waukesha, home of Les Paul, our awesome farmers market, and The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK.
Hey folks, I'm Charlie Behrens, and you are listening to the Cripescast on Civic Media. Here is my interview with comedian Sam Jay. You got stuff outside of comedy that kind of like keeps your brain, I don't know, just doing something that has nothing to do with career?
I like have my little hobbies, you know. I also, you know, I have a fiance. We go out, we hang out, we do stuff. So, you know, I have that balance of like work and life in that way. But I mean, I would say I'm pretty career focused at this stage.
What are some of your hobbies?
I like to play with Legos. I read, you know.
Nice. What Lego set you got going right now? You got a set or you just got a box?
I'm not building anything right now. I have like four sets I need to do. I'll get to them.
Yeah. Are you a build them and display them, or are you a build them and box them?
No, I'll build it and I'll leave it out until something breaks, and then I'll take it all apart and usually put them all in a bag, and then I like donate it to like a school or some kid center.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that way you don't step on them or anything. It's worse. What was the last book you read?
The last book I read was called Fly Away. It was about this woman whose best friend dies, and then like how her best friend's family gets all messed up as a result. And she was supposed to like help raise the daughter, but she gets all messed up as a result. And then kind of like how the family comes back together. It was a little bit like Beaches in a book, but it was nice.
Nice. You were saying that you want to do a book yourself. Would it be a fiction? Would it be an autobiography? You're up for whatever.
I know when I want to, I'll start writing it and it'll reveal itself. It'll tell me what it is.
I remember, I think it was one of your earlier stand-up specials. You were talking about sort of why representation matters and just having something in your life where you could say, oh yeah, that's me. I identify like that. Do you feel like since you've started your career that, you've received feedback from fans about your representation? I guess, like, do people reach out and tell you what you've kind of done for them? Are they outward about it?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes people are like, oh, you know, like, I'm a black gay woman and it's dope. Keep going, you know, stuff like that. So I think, yeah, sometimes people will reach out. I think, you know, whenever you can feel like you can relate to something that you're seeing, especially when you're not used to seeing yourself, it's probably cool. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I guess on the other end of that question, do you feel pressure at all in that or in being something for somebody or feeling the need to do things right?
Because I really can't control that because I don't know these people personally. I don't know what they need. I don't know what's correct or incorrect for them. I don't know them. So all I could do is live according to me, what I believe, what I've grown to learn, the lessons that I've learned, take them with me, try to be a better person every day, you know, try to improve upon myself and improve upon how I'm treating people in the world. That's all I can control. I can't really control the rest. So if I put that in my head, then I'm kind of running a race I can't win.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I know that's a great answer. That's very on point. I just wonder if like somewhere deep inside there's a pressure that kind of gets to you in one way or another. I guess what would be like the biggest pressure point of sort of like your career?
Things aren't going the way I want them to go.
Yeah.
I see things a certain way. And when it doesn't happen that way, or I'm like, I feel it's pressures I put on myself. It's not anything to do with anybody. It's just like, I think it should be this and it's not this yet. And why isn't it this yet? And what do I need to do to get it to this? And like, that's the kind of stuff that nags at me, but like some type of societal pressure to achieve, or I don't entertain that kind of stuff.
Got you. When you do get to a point, like you got an HBO special, you got a show, you know, you great writer. Do you feel like when you get to a point where you're like, oh yeah, I've got this, when you're not necessarily looking for the next thing to climb, are you afraid that someone's going to push you down off that mountain? Or are you trying to like look for things that can affect you? Like, is your brain always going from climbing or preventing falling?
I think I'm always going for climbing. I think if I'm afraid of anything, it's that fear of like, I don't want to not lose my love for it because it's become my job and I don't ever want it to turn into solely that. Like sometimes it is work, but I don't want it to become only work. Like, so I try to protect it. You know what I'm saying? Like I try to just make sure I'm doing things that are in line with things I believe in, to make sure like when I'm making decisions, I'm not making them from a space of money, but I'm making them from a space of, I want to do this, or I find some value in this. You know what I'm saying? I try to, when I am feeling run down by it, to take my space from it, you know, try to learn how to be better with my money so I'm less dependent on it financially, so that I know that I'm making the decisions when I want to. I just never want it to be a job. I never want to get up and go like, I have to do this comedy because I have to eat. And if I don't do this, then I won't eat. And like, I just never want to have the type of relationships I had with a job with comedy. And I think if anything, that's the fear that I have.
Yeah. Yeah. I get that. I think that idea too of just continuing to climb, you just kind of wonder what happens when, you know, in your mind you say, okay, I'm done climbing for a little bit. Like, do you freak out, you know? And I don't know. I've never gotten there.
I know one day that it has to come, right? Or you burn yourself out. So, you know, I think eventually there needs to be some type of break where you let your mind think and be. But I think that's just like life. Anything you do that you're good at, it can become all consuming. And I think you have to constantly be asking yourself questions, you know, at every turn. Like, you have to be open to the idea that there may be at a point you don't want to do this. That's okay. You know, you could hit a ceiling with this and go like, okay, I don't want to do this anymore. Maybe I want to do some whole other shit. And you just have to be open to that and not afraid of change.
Yeah, I think that's a tough thing to internalize sometimes. But I mean, those are really true words. Looking back at your career, do you have jokes that you regret? Do you ever regret a joke?
No.
Do you have jokes where you were like, I could have gone that extra step and I wish I did. I wish I took that to the next level.
All the time. Yeah. All the time. If you know, I feel like every time I do a special, I'll go back and I'm like, oh, I could have added this. I could have said that. Oh, there's more to that joke. I should have. Oh, I just thought about this. And I had said that a long time ago, but it fits with that. And that probably would have made that point a lot clearer. I just all the time. I don't think it's ever going to sit and be perfect, you know?
Right, right. But I always feel like after you film the special, then like three shows later, when you're not thinking about any of it, you're like, that was the special.
I think that you always feel like, man, I mean, it's always the night you have to capture is the night you have to capture. It's always better when you're just doing it. So like, yeah. I think you'll always feel better when you have those sets that just come in a moment and they go crazy. You'll always go like, oh, I wish I would have got this one. You know, we're like, that's just not how the sauce gets made.
Yeah, you can't have a camera crew go with you to every single thing. You go broke pretty quick doing that.
Yeah.
And there is something too about no camera, kind of you just saying, it's a little freer somehow, somewhere deep psychologically. I don't know.
So it's just different. Like you think that like you'll have these nights where you crush and you're like, that's the special. But if you watched it, you probably would go, no, it's not. Because you're in that moment and you're in that moment with that audience. When you're making a special, you're making a special for a bunch of people who are sitting at home. So it is a little more surgical and it does need to be, there's a precision job in there that is necessary to relay that shit to a person sitting on their couch. And so like those magical moments, I've accepted they're really just magical moments and they belong in that one evening. But a lot of times if you could sit back and look at the tape, you'd be like, this isn't a special. Like I kind of went wild right here. I kind of, you know what I mean? And just like, this isn't what would make a good special, but it was a good night.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. I haven't really thought about that. Cause a lot of times you're like, I know that felt better in the room, you know, but there's just some magic in that room. It's not, you know, that the audio was off or whatever, or you're listening to the crowd laughs. You're like, weren't those things bigger? You know, maybe just in my head. I don't know. But we're almost done here, but I just wanted to touch on SNL for a second. Like, what was that experience like for you? And like, is that something that you as a comedian coming up were always looking to that as like the standard or the thing to get, or did it just kind of happen?
Well, it just kind of happened. But I mean, I'm appreciative of it. It was a great experience. I learned a lot. I grew a lot. I think I grew a lot as a professional in this business. Like that was my first job, you know, I never had a job in comedy kind of really before that. Like I did like a little MTV show, but it's like, you know, you're being on cast, you did for like a month, you show up. It was just like a little weird game show thing. It didn't really require that much of me. Where this was a job, you know, you show up Monday through Saturday, you got your times, you got to be in, you got a badge, you got to swipe into the building. It's a job, you know? Yeah. So it was my first job and it taught me, it taught me how to be a professional. It made me a better writer. It made me a producer. I wasn't a producer at all, I don't think, before that job. I think I thought like a producer to some degree, but I didn't understand the applicable knowledge of it all. So it definitely just grew me overall as a comic and as a professional.
Did those sort of job type restrictions make you feel a certain way about comedy, like to where it was a job, like where you had to go do it? Or do you think it just made you stronger because it maybe puts you into a structure for a while?
Comedy, right? It wasn't my personal stand-up. It was a writing job for a show. So like, I still got to live how I wanted through my stand-up. Like it held no control over that part of my life. It just was in that space doing that thing. So it didn't, and it was also like challenging and new, and I wanted to do it. I wanted to learn it. I wanted to figure it out. I wanted to be good at it. So, you know, in that way, as grueling and sometimes mentally taxing as it could be, it was also like fun and like, I enjoyed it. You know what I mean? So it never really got there. There was just times it was just stressful, you know, and it was just, it's a intense, high performance job. And like, sometimes I can with you.
Yeah. I've heard, that kind of said a lot. Is it, what makes that job so intense? Is that it's a weekly basis kind of thing, or is it the pressure of the gig? What makes that so intense?
I think it's everything that you said, you know, like it's live television. You're doing it weekly. You know, every week there's a goal that is to execute the show. You have expectations, you know, you're working for somebody. So you have expectations. You're working with a lot of very talented people who are very, very good at what they do. And you don't want to be the weak link on the chain, you know? So you want to be very good at what you're bringing to the table. You're dealing with super duper famous people and they're under their own pressure to have a good show. And so that in the show is under pressure to give them a good show, you know? So there's just a lot happening.
Yeah. It's kind of like the perfect storm for stress. Everything you just said. Last question before I let you go, we got Christmas coming up. What is your favorite Christmas tradition from as a kid?
Leaving cookies for Santa.
What kind did you leave him?
Sugar cookies with sprinkles.
Do you make them?
Yeah, I would make them with my mom. Mm-hmm.
I always did the ones with the like Hershey's Kiss on them or whatever. Mm. I forget what those are called. They're just called kisses. I don't know. And then favorite Christmas movie?
I guess it's probably between The Grinch Who Stole Christmas and Charlie Brown.
Have you seen Charlie Brown Christmas with the sad Christmas tree, right? Do you like that Christmas tree or were you upset with that Christmas tree?
I felt bad for Charlie Brown. He always, you know, got a bad deal.
He did get a bad deal, man. He got over it though. I think that's a lesson there.
He was a good sport.
He was. Yeah. Have you ever seen Hook?
What you mean?
It's a Peter Pan movie, Hook.
Oh, have I seen Hook? Yeah, I've seen Hook.
Have you seen it recently?
No, I probably haven't watched Hook in years.
Like I hadn't.
15. It's a long time.
I'm with you. You should watch it again because, oh my God, there's like, when I was a kid, I remember like Rufio, Bangarang, you know, like Pan's Flying, the food fight. I watched it now. And like, there's this weird sexual energy between Peter Pan and Wendy in that, you know, because they had a thing. And also Tink tries to slide, you know.
Yeah, that was always there.
But I wasn't paying attention to it. And then
Tinkerbell was jealous because she was a Peter. Yeah, that was always happening.
And then like the way he runs away, like the wind comes and carries the bassinet or the bon. I don't know how you say it. The little stroller. Carries the stroll, and that was him running away. He didn't have a choice to run away. The wind blew his thing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. You didn't get all that?
I mean, I got it, but like, it's so bizarre. I feel like there are a couple plot things in there, but I love the movie. I mean, it's great. I just didn't realize like that he was his wife's grandma. That like they almost made out at the end.
Because that was a shorty, but that's not a shorty no more. She got old, but he didn't get old, so he can't be with her.
See, the way you're explaining it back to me, it's doesn't sound as bad anymore, so I appreciate that.
No, it makes perfect sense. She was young, he was young, but he was stuck in Neverland, so he couldn't grow up. She did grow up, so it wasn't perverted. They met at the right age, but he didn't grow up, and she grew up. So then when he comes out of that, she's like her kid, like the person he was married to is a reflection of her. So of course he would fall in love, but now he's older. Like he doesn't remember all that other shit.
Okay. Last one. Wendy, Moira. Moira is laying in bed. She's sleeping. And then Pan sees her and he's like, I'm going to give her a kiss. And he leaves a little thimble. And then he was like, no, Wendy, I'm going to give her a real kiss. And Wendy's just standing over looking at this. But that girl's sleeping. She can't consent to that.
That was a sweet love story. Just let it be that.
All right. You know what? You know what the problem is? Here's the problem. I grew up and I watched that movie. That's it. I grew up. There you are, Peter. That's what I got to do. I got to look in the mirror and pull my shit up.
Whether you're heading down Les Paul Parkway or fighting traffic on the interstates, this is The Shaw, 540 AM and 101.1 FM, WAUK. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Lofi's Holiday Sweepstakes is back. The Bakers of Country Hearts would like to put a little more jingle in your holiday this season by giving you a chance to win one of two $500 prizes or the grand prize of $1,000. Winners will each receive a check that can be used for travel, gifts, or just celebrating with family and friends. Whatever makes your holiday more jolly. For complete rules and to enter for your chance to win, visit facebook.com/loafiesbread.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.